You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Lizzie, what the hell is that noise?
Well, welcome to the podcast, Tom. And as usual, it is absolutely throwing it down in the middle of this glorious British summer, which we are all experiencing in the UK.
Well, it's funny, actually. I mean, a lot of the sort of Peak District-based pros are about to get back to racing. Matt is around the corner from me. He's an amateur. He's just gone back to his team in France. So any Peak District riders who have managed to keep training to the extent that you guys have deserve everything you get in the races, because the weather has been atrocious around here for the last 2 months.
It's been pretty bad, and by the magic of podcasts, by the time you guys hear this, I'm not going to be at home. I'm probably going to be in Siena on my way, or maybe mid-race in Strada Bianchi, and it's going to be pretty warm. So I've actually been cycling around at home doing all my training with as many clothes on as I can, and my friends are all like, why are you wearing knee warmers and arm warmers and a gilet? And I'm just trying to make myself really hot, because we have not had a very balmy summer here and we've had a lot of rain. But I'm really looking forward to getting to Italy and finally getting the season underway again.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, obviously, we've got a lot to get through in this episode, and I'll go through what's in this episode in a bit. But first things first, Lizzie, I mean, it's you're at the start. Well, you're sort of almost midway through a bit of a crazy journey to get to the start line for Strada Bianchi, haven't you? Because you've had to go and get a coronavirus test before you can even race.
Yeah, so the UCI rules have been brought in. And so what happens now is you have to get a 6-day coronavirus PCR test. And if that's negative, then you're allowed to join your team. And then you have a coronavirus PCR test 3 days before your race. And if that's negative, then the team is allowed to join the race bubble. And this is, you know, it's not going to be bomb-proof, let's be honest, but it's probably the best thing, or the best way, that the team and the organization can ensure that we catch as many cases as possible. And then in addition to that, we have to do a symptom tracker diary. So from 7 days out from the race, we record any symptoms that we've had that are anything to do with coronavirus. There's a tick list and you mark everything down. And if you score anything, basically you send it to your team doctor, and they'll see if they think there's a risk. But if you score anything, you're basically going to be, you know, told to not join the team. So it's not foolproof. Definitely, you know, having the final test only 3 days before the race and not the night before is not ideal, but I really think that it's probably the best thing that they can do given the circumstances. And I think that having seen the first races start in Spain just last week, by the sounds of it, from hearing how it was with my team there, my DS said that actually he felt the organisation was really, really good in making everybody as safe as possible, basically, and putting on as many regulations as they could to ensure rider and staff safety.
Well, before you set off, because you're driving down to Italy, right?
I'm driving. There. That's another anti-COVID strategy. I'm driving down, taking the tunnel, don't even have to get out of your car, and then passing our clinic, which is the Cross Clinic in Basel, that's associated with the team, getting my second PCR test, and then continuing the drive down to Siena. So, you know, that way I don't come into contact with anybody. I can basically ensure that I have my tests and I get there and I'm as safe as possible. So,
but actually getting the test, I mean, you mentioned about a week ago, getting the test was actually, in this country, was actually quite a difficult thing to do, right?
Yeah, it's a ball ache. I'm not going to lie, it's an absolute ball ache. It's really, really hard to get a test. You know, I'm not going to lie to you, this is what happened. I phoned my GP's surgery, I explained the situation. They said, well, the thing is, you can only get an NHS test if you've got a symptom. So just tell them you've got a cough. And I said, is that what you're recommending for me to do? And they said, well, I wouldn't say that I'm recommending it. But, you know, obviously I'm not going to use NHS money to get a test if those aren't the rules. But in addition to that, you have to provide a full PCR laboratory result anyway, and you can't get that with an NHS test. You only get a positive or negative stamp. You can't be guaranteed to get the laboratory results. So actually, you know, I ended up traveling over to Manchester, which is not that close, you know, an hour and a half drive. I actually took 2 hours on the way back with the traffic. to get a test. It was £150. You know, the team will reimburse it, but with smaller teams, perhaps that's not possible. And if you've got teams that aren't associated with a clinic, that's £150 or €175 times 24. You know, if there's six riders, six staff, and each person has to get two tests, that is a lot of money. You're talking, you know, roughly €4,000 per team per race. And then if there's a gap of more than a certain number of days between that race and the next race, you have to get another test. If there's a 14-day gap, you have to get another two tests before the next race. You know, it's an important thing to do, but is it sustainable? I don't know.
Well, I mean, what an arduous journey, and it's only really just beginning. You missed the Spanish races that have just taken place. There were three races in the north of Spain, weren't there, for the women? From your teammates who were racing, you said it was pretty positive. But we saw that also CCC Liv pulled out because of some problems. What do you make of everything that's happened over the last few days with that?
Basically, in the beginning, at the first race, there was some confusion surrounding whether or not there had to be testing, as I understand. I'm sure that the Cycling Podcast Femina will cover this in full and you'll get all the gory details. And so there were teams that had been tested that were made aware a couple of days before the start of the race that there were some teams that wanted to race that hadn't been tested. And of course, it's not safe. It's not allowed. And so I think there was because of the lack of clarity from the UCI to both the organisers and all of the teams involved in the race, some people ended up getting very late PCR tests. And so these PCR tests didn't actually come back before the start of the race. So there only ended up being, I think, 11 teams on the first day of racing. Thankfully, by the second day of racing, the tests had all come back negative, and so the teams were able to race. CCC Live pulled out of the first two races. They cited reasons that they were unsure about the rising case numbers in the region, and also because they were aware that teams hadn't been tested. But of course, in the end, these teams that hadn't been tested weren't allowed to race. CCC Live actually came back for the third day of racing, which was in a very slightly different area, but not that far away, let's be honest. So perhaps they'd been reassured by the testing processes. I don't know.
Well, it's one to keep an eye on. And last question before we actually do move on to the main part of this episode. Obviously, you're going to be racing Strada Bianca at the weekend. And now, obviously, that's in Italy, and the problems at the moment seem to be in Spain. But obviously, Catalonia is a place which has emerged as a bit of a hotspot. Pretty much home to, it's a huge chunk of the professional peloton lives in Catalonia. I mean, is there any sort of discomfort around that?
Well, you know, with all this, I do feel that international travel is going to be the unsticking point for coronavirus. And of course, there's a worry. I know that I'm personally doing everything I can to reduce any risks both to me and my team. I can't be sure that every single athlete that I'm going to be racing with is doing that. You know, I know, for instance, that Bols Dolmans, they are travelling from the Spanish races directly to the Italian races. They're going in their team bus, so they're keeping everything together in the team bubble, and they're basically taking as much control of the situation as they possibly can. My team, again, they're driving from Spain back to Switzerland, where they're getting their next COVID test, and then they're driving to Siena. So in ways like that, you can kind of, to a point, you can control the interactions and you can keep things within the team. But of course, there will be people flying from Catalonia. There will be people in Catalonia who are just socializing and doing what they want. It's impossible to control everybody. And it's something that to be honest, I have been anxious about. But now I've accepted that I'm just going to do everything that I can. The risk of outdoor transmission is much lower than indoor transmission. So, you know, this is my job and I'm going to go there and I'm going to make things as safe as I can for me, and I just hope all the other athletes see it the same way I do.
Whew, that was a lot of admin, Lizzie, but right, okay, news roundup time, so we're back on the tech stuff. I don't know which of these stories you might have seen, but there's been quite a few interesting stories going round, one of which we're going to do a little bit more on. The Superstrata is the world's first custom 3D printed unibody carbon fire composite bike and e-bike. Pretty exciting stuff. This is one of those crowd-funded bikes, which have had sort of mixed results. They tried to raise about 80k, and they've raised 2.5 million. Now, we've seen this sort of stuff before with the Speed X, which, when it came to manufacturing, the company basically imploded. So, if you want to watch this one, very, very interesting. And for me, one of the things that catches the eye is the 3D printed element of it. And I think for a future service course, we really need to look into 3D printing, because it's handlebars, it's helmets, it's frames. It has the potential to revolutionise how bikes are constructed. Another story that I wanted to pick out, and we've all been affected by this one pretty much, is the Garmin ransomware story. Have you been affected by this, Lizzie?
You know what? I'm going to give you a funny little anecdote, which I probably shouldn't admit for being a tech presenter. But so Tom actually texted me the other day and he said, oh, I'm going to do a little bit on the Garmin hack for this month's podcast. And I just thought, I don't know what he's talking about. Actually, ignored your text. And then a whole day went by. And then the next morning, I got a tag in a tweet from Richard saying, yeah, I talk about the bike races. I don't talk about tech. That's what Lizzie and Tom are employed to do. And then I thought, all right, I better work out what's going on with this Garmin hack now. And actually, that was the day I'd been in Manchester for this coronavirus test. And so I'd been for a really late ride and I hadn't looked to see if my ride had uploaded. And then I checked in the morning and I thought, oh, that's weird. And it was only when I got this tweet that I realised. But yeah, I mean, what a crazy story, hey? I mean, I'm sure it could happen to anyone, but oh, that's bad.
Yeah, it's a crazy story, and we are going to talk a little bit more about it. I actually interviewed a cybersecurity expert, actually an ethical hacker, who's going to talk all about that.
That is a great job. Ethical hacker.
That is a great job, yeah, yeah. The final thing I wanted to talk about in the news roundup, and this is, you know, I've got my Google Alert set, and I do like these sort of stories around the fringe of cycling tech, these sort of innovations that might take years to filter through, if they ever do at all. But this one took my fancy. There was a student at the London South Bank University who won first place at the 2020 Design Innovation in Plastics competition. I think we all agree that air pollution is a bad thing. Well, Kristen Tapping has designed a bike wheel that helps to clean the air as it spins. And I love, like I say, I love this stuff on the fringes of tech. So I spoke to her and asked her about her design.
The basic premise, it just like any purifier would work, is it takes air in, spins it around, and then ejects it, passes it through some filters, and then ejects it freer of particulates and gases. When you're on the street cycling, you know, pollution is a hard problem to quantify because you don't see it and you get used to it. So you don't even smell it anymore. But when you're in traffic, especially on your bike without a bubble around you, you're really exposed to the exhaust pipes, the heat radiating from the ground. You can really smell it. So, you know, pollution comes, there's almost a visual element to pollution that comes into play. So that was one part, just identifying the problem. And the other was, I was looking at how a home purifier works, and they pretty much go on a spinning basis in a cylinder. So why not use the same spinning basis that's already used in vehicles? Well, vehicles are already moving, so we don't need to create energy. And wheels are already turning, so that's even better, because now we have it's called centrifugal force that takes air in and pushes it out. So that's where I started off with it. Other than that, it was just a final year university project.
So, I mean, what would your vision for a product like this be then? Would it be to incorporate it in almost, I mean, could it be incorporated in almost any bike wheel? I mean, because there are a lot of different cyclists, aren't there? You know, there's the racing cyclists, there's the commuters. Is there potential for this to be scaled up so that it's just ubiquitous in all wheels?
You know, I don't think it'd be all wheels. I think it'd be more towards commuting cyclists. Obviously, with racing cyclists, I don't think their aim is to put extra weight on and get extra drag against them. Commuting cyclists, especially cycle for hire schemes, they already make the bikes quite heavy, and there's a bit more wiggle room to incorporate my design. Granted, I don't expect it to be any heavier than a wheel would be at the moment. So for scalability, my plan would be to start off with cycle for hire schemes, then go into commuter biking, and then actually look at other vehicles, cars, buses, maybe not just wheels, look at other parts of the vehicle. Why not use that inherent motion to attach filters and filter ambient air, again, right at the source of where it's happening?
All right, well, we heard that Lizzie, despite being ignorant towards it at first, was actually affected by the ransomware attack on Garmin. Like I said, I find this story fascinating, and I wanted to find out more about how ransomware attacks work, how vulnerable brands like Garmin are to these attacks, and the consequences for people who use their services. So I spoke to a guy called Joe Burns, aka Joe the Hacker.
I was told about it from one of my business partners who uses a load of Garmin devices, and then was saying about this, that it looked like they'd been breached. And it was taking everything out of action. So none of they do a lot of running and stuff, and none of their smartwatches were working, and the tracking elements weren't working. And so then I started looking at it then. But again, with any of these high profile breaches, you tend to find that the business that's been breached doesn't disclose a lot of information in the early days anyway. So I've been having a look at Garmin and what they're saying in the press, and they're keeping it very quiet. In the background, you know, because of how many things have been affected, it's not only affected like their smartwatch stuff, but it's also affected their marine and their radar stuff for airlines and things. So it's affected the business, because they've got some military influence as well, Garmin. So it's had a major influence on their business, and it does look like it's been a major ransomware breach. And from the speculation and what's been rumored, it looks like it's the same. It's the gang called Evil Corp, who's headed up by one of these Russian hackers, and there's a ransomware request reportedly of $10 million that's been put in. It doesn't, from the technique that's been used, it's very targeted. So the ransomware strain, because for anyone that doesn't know about ransomware, it will typically destroy files and make files unusable. And then the more targeted strains like this will be looking at the high-end things, so databases as well, so that it takes out applications. And that's what we're seeing here, is that their entire website, even their, you know, their call centers are out of action. There's been huge implications from what's happened. So it's pretty serious. So the typical strategy for these high profile ones, because you've got to bear in mind that the company is probably spending quite a lot in trying defending against cybersecurity threats. So it's not, and we heard of Twitter getting hacked the other week, and high profile accounts like Elon Musk, Bill Gates and things getting compromised. You know, so Twitter equally will spend a lot of money on keeping cybersecurity threats out. But the problem that most businesses face is there's always going to be some sort of weakness. Generally, people in like the Twitter breach, that we know that that was a social engineering attack. So in this case, it could be that they found a weakness in an individual. So somebody's followed an instruction, somebody's clicked on something they shouldn't have done within the business, because so it's usually social engineering. So you target an individual within that organization who might be a weakness. And the other thing is open vulnerabilities. So let's say, for example, going back, another example, a big ransomware was TravelX, which was earlier this year. And with TravelX, they found a weakness that wasn't patched in their system. So it can either be a person, which is quite common, or it can be something they've left unpacked, something that's open and vulnerable that the security team hasn't already dealt with. And as you can imagine, there's so much that an organization needs to keep patched, keep on top of. You've got budget constraints, so quite often things do get missed, and there's a gaping hole that can be utilized. Any business is going to have something that a hacker can use to get in. The difficulty, the challenge is always, you don't know what you don't know. The attackers are always trying to break in, and they're always trying different techniques and different ways to get in. The difficulty is, it's attack versus defense constantly. And the attackers are generally always one step ahead of the defenders, because something has to happen. Some attack works, and then all the defenders have then got to go, right, we need to stop that now. So there's always one high profile example, which then makes other people put those defenses in place. So I don't really think that any organization won't be completely immune to the potential that a hacker's going to get in at some point. When I was looking at this and looking at the consequences of data and personal data, now I'm pretty open. You know, I'm a security conscious guy, but when it comes to certain things, there's some elements of data that I'm like, I'm really not that bothered about. You know, so for example, if you're tracking your rides and where you're going, it's all anonymized anyway. But in terms of that kind of data, I wouldn't be too concerned about losing that. Do you know what I mean? But at the same time, there is some personal data in there that you should be worried if there's a breach. For example, the classic is usernames and passwords. So if there's a username and password and that data is breached and that is compromised, then what we've seen over and over again is the criminals, the cyber criminals, take a breached password and a username, and then they go and try and use that on lots of different things. Now, you know, inherently people tend to use the same usernames and passwords. You shouldn't do that. Every password should be unique. And you've got, you know, security guys like me saying to people, every password should be unique. But people don't quite get the reasons. But the reason is, if I can steal one password from anything, and then I go and use it on your email account, and I go and use it on your Facebook account, your LinkedIn account, your PayPal account, and you've got the same password for everything, I'm just going to get access to everything. Which means that, and if I can get into your email account, for example, then all I'm going to do is go around everything and click forgot password, and it will send me an email to reset that password, which gives me total control of your life, really. And you can easily then lock out an individual and do a lot of damage to somebody. So that's why it's important to have unique passwords. So with some data, I'd kind of say I wouldn't be too bothered if somebody knew of some data, but other information, personal information, I'd want to keep safe, and I would be conscious of losing that if a company got breached. Now, the other interesting thing is Strava have gotten a heat map, anonymized heat map of every location where one of these, you know, fitness trackers have been used for GPS data. And the interesting thing is the consequences of that data is that, for example, Area 51, you can map out where people have been in GCHQ, Area 51, border control. You know, you can start to see patterns of behavior that people are doing at quite secret locations. So although for individual sake, it might not be that bothered, you might not be bothered about what data you're giving, en masse, it can reveal quite a lot about what's going on in a nation state. So that's a worry in its own right.
So talking to Joe about the ransomware attack on Garmin got me thinking to wider issues of data security in cycling, and particularly the way we share a lot of data via Bluetooth and Ant Plus devices. And we all know that cycling teams are very protective of that data. We see stuff get posted to Strava, but not everything goes up there. You know, cyclists are very protective of their training plans and their power profiles. But I wondered if some of this data flying around, you know, for example, outside the team buses as riders come back from a stage, I wonder if that data is vulnerable and could be hoovered up by someone with the right equipment.
Generally, no. There are things in place to prevent that. But talking, just quickly, grab one of my hacking tools, one second. So one of the devices that I often demonstrate to people on when I'm doing security talks is this device. It's called a Wi-Fi Pineapple. You can buy it online. It's about $100 for this device. Now, this is good for doing for connecting wireless devices to here. I can then connect them through the internet through another wireless adapter. So I can tether through my phone, get people to connect to this, and then that's known as what's called man in the middle. So this device sits between them and the internet, which means that I can start watching traffic that goes back and forth from their device. So that's quite useful. But let's say going back 10 years ago, that was a lot more useful because hardly any encryption was used for websites. You know, if you go onto the internet nowadays, every site pretty much starts with HTTPS and instead of HTTP. The difference between that one letter is encrypted versus not encrypted. Back when not a lot of the sites were HTTPS, any traffic going through there, I could see what was being sent. I could see the information that was being sent. Obviously, there's been a big change in that and in how people work and how websites and people have become more security aware. And now it's very difficult to read traffic. So when it comes to like personal devices that are sending anything to the cloud, you would pretty much, I don't know the full extent of every single application, but you would almost guarantee they're going to be using an encrypted channel for sending that data to the cloud. So you can't necessarily steal it whilst it's communicating from one point to another as a hacker. And that's why it's good to try and steal it at rest. You know, when it's in a database and it's not in an encrypted state, passwords should be encrypted, but a lot of data won't be encrypted by default. So if you can steal the data from a database, that's much more use because it's a lot easier than trying to steal it while it's on the move. So I wouldn't necessarily say there's a big risk of information being stolen by somebody just sat there watching traffic going to the internet.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, that's the voice of Seb Piquet interrupting this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it is sponsored by the Watt Bike Atom.
That's right, Rich. Yeah, the Watt Bike Atom. Well, people who listened to our Tour de France coverage last year will have been very familiar with the Watt Bike Atom indoor smart trainer because they sponsored pretty much the whole of our Tour de France coverage last year. And I must admit, when I was riding our Giro a little bit earlier this year, doing a lot of hours on my indoor turbo trainer and a lot of climbing on that route that Daniele Frubrancini set for us, I was really craving the Watt Bike Atom because of its stability and the fact that it is easier to get out of the saddle because of that stability. You can really kind of, you know, lean down on the handlebars, not the way that you would outdoors necessarily, but it was certainly a lot more stable than riding a bike set up on a turbo trainer, and I kind of really appreciated that.
Well, we were both lucky enough to have the Watt Bike Atom in our high performance fitness studios before the Tour de France last year, just to enable us to get to peak fitness for 3 weeks of eating and drinking our way around France in the back of a car. But it was great fun, and I mean, having spent a lot of time on my own bike on the turbo, there's just something I'm not as comfortable getting out of the saddle. That the sort of vast power that I put through the machine always makes me worry about, you know, breaking something. The Watt Bike Atom feels incredibly sturdy, which is one of the advantages of it. And the other thing I really enjoyed from using it was the information that you get from it, the pedaling effectiveness score and the left-right balance that you get. You get a really interesting insight into what each leg is doing, and you know, perhaps are able to work from that on balancing yourself out.
And being somewhat inept sometimes with technical things, as I am, Richard, I really appreciated the fact that the Atom's Bluetooth connectivity to third-party apps like Zwift or the Sufferfest or Trainer Road, really, you know, it was as easy as that. You turn on the Watt Bike Atom, you turn on your phone or your computer, and they talk to each other, and there was none of that kind of pre-ride faff which eats into the time you've got available to get on your bike and ride. Well, the Watt Bike Atom has got a host of these great features, and it feels great to ride. But now it is back with the next generation Watt Bike Atom, which is launching now. The next generation Watt Bike Atom features the same great connectivity that I just talked about, but it has a completely new electromagnetic resistance system for an even more realistic ride feel, and instant gear changes for those who are looking to advance their Zwift racing career. For those who are serious about the numbers, new crank angle sensors read your pedaling data 1,000 times every second, providing you with a data set that is within a plus or minus 1% accuracy range, so it's got more granular data for your own marginal gains. To top it off, the bike is still packaged in its award-winning design. So to find out more and purchase a Watt Bike Atom for £90 a month, go to wattbike.com. That's wattbike.com.
Okay, so we finally arrive at the sort of the meat of this episode, and this episode was going to be solely about head injuries and about helmets and about concussions, and that is something that's been in the news much more recently. There's been a lot more press coverage. There's been a lot more research that's gone into the effects of head injuries on athletes. Lizzie, you've had a concussion yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had a few. I've actually had quite a few whacks to the head against the tarmac. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this episode, because there are a lot of differences in different helmets across the manufacturers. There are actually quite a lot of different technologies that are coming in to try and improve helmets. And yeah, I just wanted to kind of see what research is out there, hear from the manufacturers, also understand a little bit more about the implications of head injuries. And then finally, later on in the episode, we're going to catch up with Ian Boswell, who, as you guys will know, had a career-ending concussion last year. And we're just going to see how he's getting on, basically. But before we start, there is a lot of tech surrounding helmets and concussions. And I think that we actually need a kind of a bit of a glossary of terms before we go through, and the who's and the what's and what we're talking about, because there's so many different systems on the market that it can all get pretty confusing.
Okay, let's start with EPS, because this is the one term I think I do understand.
Yeah, so expanded polystyrene foam. You've all seen it. You've all got it in your helmets. It's that black stuff that is the core of nearly all helmets.
Direct impact?
So this is the big cause of skull fractures. If you drop a head directly onto the floor, then you're going to get a direct impact, and that's what's going to cause a skull fracture.
Rotational impacts?
Now, this is a really big one in cycling and the biggest driver of concussion. And this one's quite a big problem because many standardized helmet tests, and I say many standardized because actually there isn't a helmet standard test across the whole world. Different places have different ones. So most standardized helmet tests just have a vertical drop test, and they don't actually have a requirement for rotational impacts, which are the biggest drivers of concussion. So that's something that we're going to talk about a little bit later.
MIPS.
So MIPS stands for Multidirectional Impact Protection System. And what it is it's a plastic liner inside your helmet. And the idea of it is that if you crash, it rotates separately to your helmet to help reduce the impact of rotational forces.
WaveCell?
So WaveCell is Bontrager's proprietary system. Sorry, you can really hear the rain coming down now, which is a multidirectional crumple zone which lines the inside of the helmet and replaces some of the EPS foam in the helmet.
Choroid, is that right?
Choroid.
No. Choroid, okay, yeah, nearly close.
Choroid. So choroid is a honeycomb structure. It looks similar to lots of straws just kind of glued together. And this is inserted into areas in the helmet, or sometimes it's a full liner of the helmet. And again, this aims to provide a multidirectional crumple zone to reduce direct and rotational impacts.
Right, we're almost there. Spin.
Spin is an interesting one. It's POC's proprietary system, which aims to decrease the impact of rotational forces. It's a silicon gel-like membrane that actually sits in the pad. So it's essentially just a pad when you're looking at it. And finally, Tom.
Yeah, I'm gonna do my best at this. Hovding?
Hovding. Yeah, I can't say it. It's a Swedish word. But so we're going to talk about the hovding in a minute, but I just wanted you to know what it is, because it's something that you may or may not have seen before. It's not a traditional helmet. It's a novel helmet system that's actually worn around the neck like a scarf. And when an impact is detected by this helmet, an airbag is deployed and it covers and encases the whole head.
So this is back to that sort of fringe tech stuff that I absolutely love. I have seen that and I'm very, very intrigued by it.
So sorry to overwhelm you with all that information, but I do think it's important to know what we're talking about before we move on, because today we're looking at some research from the Road Safety Trust in the UK, and they are an independent organisation who, well, they want to make the roads safer for everyone. In 2018, there were 4,000 serious or fatal cycling injuries in the UK, over 18,000 hospital admissions in England, Scotland and Wales, and a whopping 78% of these admissions were likely to have sustained a head injury. I spoke with Helena Stigson, who's a road safety professor and conducted the independent research for the Road Safety Trust. To give you a brief overview, 27 helmets were provided by the Road Safety Trust, and tests were performed to measure both shock absorption and the effects of oblique impacts, and computer simulations were performed to measure the rotational and translational accelerations. These are the tests that give you the best idea of how well a helmet is going to protect you against concussion.
What you can do, and what we are highlighting in our test, is that we are doing oblique impacts. that's more realistic, that mirror what happens in a real crash. When you're hitting the ground, you always got a velocity that are putting you into the ground with an oblique impact. So what we have done is that we performed three different oblique impacts, and that also when we are doing that in the test lab, we are also taking the pulse that we get into the crash dummy head into a model, like a FEM model, to see what actually happened in the brain. So it's a mathematic model of the brain, and then you can see what actually happens. But if you're looking at the brain in neurons, that's more equal to what happens in rotational energy, and that's more that you can see in the oblique impacts.
So your independent study rated 8 of the helmets as recommended, meaning that they performed higher than average across all the tests. 7 of these were conventional road helmets, 6 of which included the MIPS liner, and the 7th used the Bontrager's wave cell technology. However, the highest rated helmet of all was the Hoofding 3, excuse my pronunciation, which is not something we see very often in the UK. Can you tell me a bit more about this helmet and why it was quite so highly rated in your tests? Because it scored almost 3 times higher, which is a lot, or 3 times less likely to cause brain injury.
Yeah, that's more like a head protector. It's more like a scarf that you're wearing around your neck, and then when a crash occur, it will inflate, and then it's based on a big airbag around your head, and of course that is more thicker, and since it's a airbag, it will spread out the crash or the impact during such a long period that you can actually absorb much more energy. So that's the reason why it turned out so well in the test. And of course, when you compare it with conventional helmets, it's you got the EPS that should absorb the energy, and it's roughly over around 15 milliseconds. But with the Hoofding, you can spread out it much longer duration.
So going back to the other 7 conventional helmets, it was interesting to see that all of these used a system that aimed to reduce the impact of rotational or torsional forces, which are the biggest causes of traumatic brain injury. So what I wanted to know was, from Helena's tests, was it clear that one of these applications was better than the other? And also, how would she rate the spin shearing pad inside technology?
As I said, the ones that are recommended have some sort of protection for rotational loading. But it's also clear that the ones that are fitting with this systems are not a safe helmet. It needs to be a good helmet from the beginning, because one of the ones that came out the worst in our test was actually fitted with the MIPS system. So it really has to be a good helmet from the beginning. And for the spin, it doesn't seem to add so much protection. And if you are looking into the systems, it's you can see that you would need to do something more than just adding some padding. And I also think that the MIPS system or the well cell could be much better if they actually add more efforts to protect from the whole perspective, from both rotational loading and energy absorbing.
Interesting.
But it's a good start, and we can see when we started, it was just one helmet that had the MIPS system, and now when you're going into a store, you can find almost every brand with with some rotational technology. So it's clear that in this case, consumer testing can actually play an important role.
In development, yeah. I wanted to ask you about choroid, because does choroid aim to reduce rotational forces as well?
We haven't tested it in this. We have in our ski helmet test, we had a wide range of different technology for rotational loading. But actually, it seems to like, up to date, it's just the MIT system and the well cell that has been performing good in the test.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to ask is because in my previous team, I used a Smith helmet, which had your standard EPS foam, choroid, and a MIPS liner. Yeah. And one of my questions was, you know, why don't we combine these technologies? You know, why don't we use WaveCell and good quality EPS and a MIPS liner as well, you know? And if you can combine all of these, and then maybe put some spin pads in as well, why not? Maybe if you can combine all of these, can you therefore reduce the risk of TBI? Or is it kind of a problem with marketing and people not wanting to use MIPS and WaveCell?
Yeah, it's. I think it's but when it comes to the design, that it's actually a competition between these, and it has been some issues with the different companies and so on. So that's of course one part. If you're looking as a researcher, it's of course better that you're working with the helmet, because what we saw in some of our tests back in the days, we could see that the helmets with the MIPS system actually had a much stiffer EPS. And of course, for rotational, then to make the system to start working, then it's good to have a stiffer helmet, but you don't really know if the MIPS system works in reality. But it's just in the lab that you can see that it is working. So we are trying to find out in real world crashes, does it work as good as it do in the lab? And of course, as you said, if you combine them to have a more energy absorbing in the helmet, and then adding something for taking care of rotational energy, that would be the optimum, I would say. So, and when we had one of the Smith helmets with the honeycomb structure in the like, that's probably like 3-5 years ago, and it was too stiff. So you really need to combine that, and I think that's important when you are looking into a new standard, because they are trying to the test that we are performing is actually on discussion at the European safety standard committee, and if you are adding something, then you need to perhaps you should test the helmets in different velocities and so on, because it's like it is today, it's just that you need to fulfill 250G when you're dropping the helmet to the anvil from 1 meter. And that's clearly, that doesn't really mirror the whole situation for a cyclist.
Mm.
And another interesting part that I just... last year, when it was the biggest race in Sweden, around one of the biggest lake, it's a 300 kilometers ride. Then it was one of the professional that actually had a quite a severe head impact. And I had a discussion with him afterwards, because he was taking care of some medical people around, and then I could see his head, and he had a Oakley helmet with the MIPS system, and I had just perform the test with it, and then I know that it was a really stiff one, and what I could see in his head was that he had contusions into to the skin, and it was really red, and you can actually see the whole frame on his head. And then, of course, for him, it would be much better if the helmet would be absorbing more of the energy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I had a bad crash 6 days before my wedding, and I was actually, yeah, I was in a race, and basically I went over the handlebars, landed on the back of my head. I was really fortunate not to sustain a concussion this time, but the helmet did crack, but it also, because it was quite a direct impact, actually. For a bike crash, it was unusually direct because I kind of flipped and then landed straight on the floor. And the helmet split, but the helmet pressed into the back of my head really hard. And then I had a 10 centimeter laceration in my hairline across the back of my head. So that was interesting, trying to do my hair for my wedding. So you said before about how I think I understand in saying basically the design of the EPS foam is really quite important, because you were saying that whether or not you've got a good liner, it's whether it's a good helmet to start with. So is that about the type of EPS foam? Is that about where the EPS is placed? Because I have to say, I don't really know much about EPS foam other than we have it in all our helmets. So what is it that makes that helmet good in the first place? For instance, the Specialized Prevail was, you know, the second high after the Hovding, it was the highest rated one. Why is that better with even without a liner?
Yeah, that's when you're looking into helmets, it's more or less the thickness of the EPS that you can use, and also the density, of course. And that was actually, like 3 years ago, we tested one of the POC helmets that perform very good. And we had it with both MIPS and without. And then we could see that it was really thick on some part of the helmets there. Because you can, as a helmet manufacturer, it's important to also look into where actually you hit the head. Because, of course, if you are studying real-world crashes, and you can see like some part locations will be more frequently impact, and of course if you're adding more into this part of the helmets, then the consumer will hopefully get less concussions or brain injuries or skull fracture if they are hitting the head into the ground on these locations. So you can really work very well with the design, and also try to make it thicker on some part of the helmet.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks, as always, to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast and all the other things that we do over here, including Service Course. And I also want to thank Science in Sport for the Rego Rapid Recovery Powder, which basically fuels all my recovery these days. For those who don't know, I've been shielding for the last few months. I've not ridden on the road since the start of this year, so all my riding has to be done indoors and on the turbo. And one of the only things that gets me through it is knowing that I'll get a good recovery drink when it's over, because riding on the turbo day after day after day can be a little bit soul destroying. And that reminds me as well, I do need to try the new Science in Sport range designed specifically for turbo training. Not to say that you can't use it out on the road as well, but it has been developed for that, so I really need to try that. If you want to try any of these products, then you can get 25% off. Just go to scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code CP25. That's scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code CP25. All right, glossary review number two. The terminology around brain injuries can also be pretty confusing. When we talk about TBIs, well, that's a traumatic brain injury, which sounds pretty scary. So concussion, that sounds not quite so bad, right?
Wrong. A minor concussion is actually a minor traumatic brain injury. And when you put it like that, it starts to sound a bit more serious. Maybe something that we shouldn't go, oh, he's just had a small concussion. So what's CTE then? Well, it stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. In layman's terms, repeated trauma to the head that causes long-term damage or disease to the brain, which in turn causes physical and mental alterations to how you function.
Well, CTE has been overlooked, I think, in the past. We hear a lot more about it now. There's been some quite high-profile incidents involving, well, particularly American football players. Over in the UK, a lot of people have heard of Jeff Astle, the former footballer who passed away a couple of years ago. He had dementia from CTE, from repeated heading of a football. So I actually got in touch with the CTE Centre at Boston University to find out more. And I spoke to Chris Nowinski, who's actually got personal experience of concussion and traumatic brain injuries.
So I'm Dr. Chris Nowinski. I'm co-founder and CEO of the Concussion Legacy Foundation. We're a nonprofit that's focused on taking care of patients and families who have had too many concussions or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, advancing research on the long-term effects of getting hit to the head so that we can eventually have effective treatments, and changing sports so that we don't recreate these same mistakes and can prevent this damage. So I played football, American football at Harvard University, and I got out without ever having a diagnosed concussion. Got into wrestling, had experiences that I now know were concussions and had them my whole life. And I just never realized when you got hit in the head and you blacked out, forgot where you were, or had, you know, searing headaches or double vision that mattered. Just seemed like a normal consequence of getting hit in the head, and eventually it went away. And so in June 2003, I got a really bad one that I didn't appreciate how bad it was, and I wasn't trained that you don't go back in. And so I lied about how bad my head hurt for 5 weeks just trying to power through it, and just sort of turned my brain into mush and never got better and was forced to retire.
It's interesting, you know, you talk about that lying to yourself and lying to your coaches. I mean, that is a kind of common theme of this, isn't it?
It's the most common theme. Understanding your own brain injury is very difficult because the tool that you use to understand your injury is impaired. And no one tells you your brain doesn't have pain nerves in it. And pain is what usually tells athletes when to stop. And your brain can't give you pain. So you never would think, like, you know, again, like sensitivity to light or a headache or something is worth stopping for, because you can usually power through it if you can remember who you are. The self-regulation around concussions for athletes has been enormously hard to do. And even with training, it's enormously hard to do. And so that's why we emphasize a lot of educating teammates and putting protocols in place, because you really have to have a lot of stopgaps to catch these and treat them properly.
So in terms of sports then, what are the mistakes that sports make in terms of their protocols when dealing with concussions?
Where do you begin? So the first mistake is that we still do not prioritize prevention. So concussions, you know, the storyline we're sort of fed is that 90% of people are fine, 10% of people have longer experiences, and poor them, it's probably something they did. And that's not the case. We do a terrible job recognizing concussions because we don't train the athletes to realize that those seemingly mild symptoms are actually very significant. And then we also don't train those around them to recognize that an athlete is a terrible, is the wrong person to determine if their concussion is serious, right? It's the same idea as asking a drunk driver if they should drive, right? They're impaired. They can't make that choice. It's your job to take away the keys. Right now, far less than half of concussions are being diagnosed when they occur. And then after that, it's a question of, are you removing them? That depends on the infrastructure you have. If you have doctors on the sideline, they're probably not going back. But if you have physios or athletic trainers, probably not going back. But most places don't have that. So if you don't have any medical professionals there, a lot of those people are going right back in. And that will make their concussion worse. And then if you do get them off the field, we generally do a good job in the States of making sure they're not getting back into a dangerous place for at least a week. But that's not the case again everywhere.
Speaking to cycling then, sort of one big concern in cycling with regards to concussions or TBIs, it's the management immediately after a crash. A bike race is a moving thing. If you pause for a moment, it moves on. So there's very much a kind of, you know, check you out. Can you see? Can you pedal? Get back on your bike, basically. I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to say, but do you have any suggestions for how to manage cases like this in the field?
So yeah, it's a great question. Competition-wise, it'll be complicated. But if you look at it from the perspective of the athlete's health and what's best for them, we have a very strong rule in our sports, and I think it's also the same rule now in world rugby. You can't do a concussion assessment in less than 10 minutes. Like, impossible, right? Those of us who've had them know that the symptoms you feel 30 seconds in are different from what you feel 3 minutes in and different from what you feel 8 minutes in. And so I'm sure what's happening over and over again is people are having a crash, hitting their head, they get up, they do a quick 30-second, minute-long assessment. At that point, the symptoms haven't showed up. You've got this dramatic burst of adrenaline because you just had a traumatic impact. You can't feel anything. You get back, and if you can pedal, you're gone. Once you start pedaling, those symptoms for some people are coming on, right? Your head starts hurting, you feel wobbly, you feel foggy. But you're not stopping because you've already made that choice, you know, in a public setting that I don't have a concussion. And so you lie your way through the end of the race and then you pray to God you feel better tomorrow and go. And that's what's happening. And so if you had a choice of what to do, if it's you and your career, if this is not the Tour de France, you stop and you sit down for 10 minutes or 15 minutes and you just, you know, you take your time and cool off to see. If, you know, ideally you're assessed by somebody. If you can't be assessed by somebody, at least self-assess and give the symptoms time that you go on. Give yourself some time to realize this isn't worth it. But you could imagine, like, we have this problem in baseball in America because they don't want to stop the game to assess somebody. So we always, every year, have players who are running into the wall or getting hit in the head by a batted ball, and they're clearly impaired. But so they give them 2 minutes and they talk to them. And they don't take them off the field to assess them, and they have to choose right then and there. And they leave them in, and time after time, the next inning, they're taking them out. We have to educate the cyclists so that if they are in a situation where they feel like they have to get back on, they also feel confident enough and educated enough to know, if I don't feel right a mile down the course, I got to stop. Because not only is it bad for their brain recovery, but reaction time and balance are impaired, and you're going to kill yourself.
So I don't know if you'll be able to answer this one, but I'll try it anyway. So obviously we're talking about helmet technology on this podcast. And there are different forces at play when you have an impact. Can you talk about rotational forces and the sort of role they play in the severity of concussion?
Yeah, rotational forces are the primary driver of concussion severity. So your brain is sort of designed to take on linear acceleration, because when you tear axons, it's not the energy wave going through your brain. Like that, the energy wave itself can cause a concussion, but it won't tear axons. Axonal shearing, axonal tearing is being caused by rotational acceleration and shearing at the gray white matter junction, or a lot of energy goes to the depths of the sulcus, where we see the beginning of CTE. But it's that centripetal force, it's the pulling, when you twist a brain, the pulling of the brain away from itself that is causing that physical damage that's going to be more correlated with longer-term problems, more significant. Every helmet's tested sort of differently, and there's different certifications and for different sports. You know, I'm most familiar with football. And with football, the standard drop test means that you're putting a helmet on a head form. Now they have necks that move a bit, but they certainly aren't replicating humans perfectly. And you basically, from different heights, drop the head form with the helmet on it and measure the energy to the head. It reaches the head and measure the acceleration, deceleration. There's various standards you have to meet to pass a certification. You have to be, so much energy has to be dissipated. And the helmet has to be a certain level, offer a certain level of protection to be certified. Those, it's impossible to replicate the various vectors of impact and energy of rotation with a human head that's got also a soft brain on the inside. Helmet testing does not replicate the human experience. And so while it's probably, you know, the best we can do, and there's certainly debates about how do you test it better, just because a helmet passes the test doesn't mean it's going to protect you as much as you'd like it to. You know, don't rely on your helmet to save you from brain injury. You should rely on it to save you from skull fracture, but you can get pretty messed up with a helmet.
The interesting stuff there, obviously, we talked a little bit about the role that helmets can play in, you know, in rider safety. But I think the interesting stuff there was around the kind of protocols that are involved in sport when someone has a head injury. And it's difficult to see in cycling how you can, by following any of the recommended protocols, how you can ever let a rider get back on their bike after having a head injury, having a crash.
Well, you say the recommended protocols, Tom, but I'm not actually sure if what or, you know, whatever they are. I'm not saying that there aren't any. I'm saying I actually don't know. If there is a protocol to say if a rider hits their head, they shouldn't carry on, then it's most definitely not adhered to. As far as I know, there's no kind of UCI medical rule or anything. It's kind of down to team doctor, rider, manager judgment. But it's just something that's impossible. You know, you can't judge straight away when you've hit your head whether you're right or not. And it's also impossible because often you're in the middle of a stage race. If you stop, that's it. You know, you can't carry on the rest of the stage. That's literally it. So I don't really see a way around it. I mean, in a minute you're going to hear me talking with Ian, and you know, we talk about the possibility of how to create a culture change. But I just don't know how that's going to happen, to be honest.
Well, you know, back onto the subject of culture change, before we hear from Ian, you know, Chris there was also talking about it's not the individual rider's responsibility to say, yeah, I'm fine, because when you've had a concussion or whatever type of brain injury, the very organ that you use to make sense of things is actually damaged. So you're in no place to say, yeah, I'm fine. And actually, he's talking there about the burden being on team staff and on teammates. And I wondered whether, you know, that might be something that you look out for. You know, would you be someone more vocal to say, you know, that rider, my teammate, they can't carry on. They need to be pulled out.
Definitely. I mean, I've not had this situation during a race, but definitely after a race, I have been really strict with my teammates about, you know, when they're not sure whether they've got a concussion or not, or it's minor in inverted commas. And so do not use your phone. I know it's boring, but lie down, look at the ceiling, try not to, you know, have too much visual stimulation, and just take it seriously until you know, because it is not something that's worth messing with. So finally, when we were talking about this episode, I couldn't help thinking back to the Great Cycling Podcast episode over the winter, where Richard interviewed Ian Boswell about his serious concussion, which actually caused him to end his professional career. It was an incredibly insightful interview that's worth going back and listening to, and I really wanted to know how Ian was getting on now. Of course, we hear what he's up to regularly over on the Explore podcast, but I had a chat with Ian about how his concussion recovery is going all these months on.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot better now, and I was on a ride yesterday and some people were asking me, and I was like, yeah, I mean, most days I feel largely normal again. You know, there are still symptoms that, you know, I guess at this point in my life or this point in my recovery kind of feel like this is kind of just the new normal, which is a word that's been used a lot recently. But yeah, I mean, I still do have some like ocular symptoms, especially, you know, with my eyes. And like one of the biggest things I notice now is my dilation of my eyes. So if I'm outside and I walk into a dark room, or, you know, if I'm wearing sunglasses and I take them off, my eyes, the dilation is really slow to respond. So driving at night, you know, I wear like a sunglass because, you know, oncoming cars, you know, driving down a dark road is really distracting. Then I guess at the end of a long work day, if I have a long email to read, I struggle to concentrate, but it's more so due to just my eyes not being able to track across the screen. And it's it's kind of like, you know, essentially just training. I just have to keep practicing and doing it. I notice it more under fatigue if I've been working all day on my computer or, you know, reading stuff. By the, you know, come 4 o'clock, I'm like, oh, this is hard to follow.
So the majority of your symptoms have been visual then. Are you still getting headaches, or is it really just the visual symptoms that are still bothering you?
Yeah, it's mostly just the vision stuff. You know, I do tend to sleep a lot more than I used to. You know, like naps are actually incredibly beneficial to me. Some of the doctors I actually saw said that I was sleeping too much. You know, kind of any recovery, you have to like keep, you know, physical therapy. It's like about keeping that motion going and keeping moving. So I've been trying to just be more cognizant about, you know, when I sleep and how I sleep, because it's easy for me to, you know, take an hour nap during, you know, the afternoon and then, you know, still want to go to bed early. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's, there's days when I feel like, okay, I'm back to normal and I'm riding and I'm, you know, riding my bike down a hill and I'm like, oh, I feel fine. And there are still days when I feel like there's a step backwards. And I think the biggest struggle for me, being, you know, 29 years old and like a former professional road cyclist, is sometimes admitting to myself or acknowledging that things aren't all the same. Cause I want to tell myself that, yeah, everything's the same and I'm fine and I'm healthy and, you know, I'm still young, but there are definitely times when I have to like realize like, all right, you know, I can't do this, or I, you know, I shouldn't be doing this. But yeah, it's one of those situations where you just have to be honest with yourself. And I've still been involved with quite a few concussion kind of groups here in the US. One's called Love Your Brain, and it's like a yoga meditation course for people recovering from TBIs. And that's one of like the biggest kind of messages that is shared amongst this group, is just that people aren't always honest with themselves. And that's like so important to realize kind of where you're at and, you know, where you are in this journey to recovery. And for some people, you know, maybe myself included, you know, part of that is kind of accepting where you are and that things may never be the way they were, but you can still kind of work towards getting back to how and what you felt before.
I think what's one of the things that's really interesting about your situation is partly that you've made it public and you've talked about it, which I think really doesn't happen very often, because partly of the nature of our careers, and you never want to admit something because you're trying to be the best, and you know, if you've got something wrong with you, then, or in inverted commas, something wrong with you, then perhaps a new team won't sign you or whatever. But I think it's really important to talk about these experiences of concussion, because so often these symptoms, you know, the ocular symptoms that you're talking about, then they're not spoken about. We talk about, oh, have you had a headache? Are you feeling a bit dizzy? But there are so many other symptoms of concussion. And I wonder if you're still in contact with the specialists, and perhaps can your symptoms become a case study to help people, you know, in similar experiences, cyclists, other athletes in the future, understand and better recognize symptoms of concussion and perhaps create a better protocol for dealing with it?
Yeah, so it's kind of become a side passion project for me. So the hospital that I went to in North Carolina, it's called UNC, the University of North Carolina, they have a pretty extensive concussion research program. And they've actually been incredibly helpful after the concussion and like wanting to put resources and kind of, you know, staff towards implementing some type of protocol or just awareness within cycling. Cause I went down there last September and was kind of telling them about, you know, my story and then, you know, other stories I've heard in cycling, and they were just blown away about how little kind of information and awareness there is in cycling. So I'm working with them and then the ANARPC, which is like the North American Riders Union and a branch off of the CPA, like the, yeah, UCI's Riders Union. But it's been challenging to actually figure out what we can do, you know, because it's largely the teams and the team doctors, and, you know, maybe it's a race physician trying to diagnose a concussion, you know, immediately. But I think the biggest struggle in professional sport is actually, you know, just awareness. And it's just awareness of, like you said, what you should be looking for after you've had a crash, because oftentimes the athlete, you know, more so than the medical staff, they want to get back on the bike. You know, maybe the doctor's like, oh, I'm not sure about this, but I feel like as an athlete, you become very good at hiding symptoms and maybe not being completely honest, because your drive to race and return to racing is so powerful. But, you know, as in my case, you know, with ocular, you know, kind of symptoms, you know, that you're very prone to actually crashing again. And that's extremely dangerous if you have two you know, two head injuries within a short period of time. So it is something that we're looking at doing. You know, the first thing would be identifying, you know, has someone had a concussion? And largely that's going to be up to the athlete to actually be honest with themselves and team staff or race doctors. And this kind of, you know, this eventually this does trickle out to the wider cycling community. And how do we, you know, how do we identify concussions? And then what are the resources that you need to actually recover as quick as possible? And that's one of the things unique in cycling is that most riders, I mean, professional cycling, is that most riders are on short-term contracts. And so if teams and, you know, organizations actually invested in the recovery process, you're going to have a better athlete returning to play quicker than you would if you did nothing. You know, in my case, it was very much, okay, we don't really know what to do. Go back to the U.S. and seek help and let us know when you're ready to come back. And thankfully, you know, I, you know, just through neighbors and connections and people reaching out, I was able to kind of get the help I needed, but it took a lot longer than if there was a system in place where, you know, there's maybe some centers of excellence throughout Europe. Maybe there's one in France, one in Belgium, Spain, and then, you know, teams were kind of associated with those hospitals and you could go there, you know, a day or 2 days after your crash and actually be seen and evaluated and then put on a recovery program for your specific symptoms as quick as possible.
It's quite amazing, really, that in a sport like cycling, where we crash so much and we are so susceptible to head injuries and concussions and traumatic brain injuries, that we don't have a better system and a better protocol in place. And in the men's side of the sport, you're much more likely and probably, I don't know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but probably always have a team doctor on the race. But in women's cycling, only a very few of the teams will have a team doctor on the race. In my team, we're very fortunate to have a doctor on call all the time. And if any of us ever crash, we always speak to him immediately after the race, but that's not the case across the board. Have you ever had concussion baseline testing kind of pre-season or a standardized concussion protocol within a team?
So we actually did do a pre-season test with Team Sky, I believe it was 2014, in the winter. So they did implement something, but again, with these tests, it wasn't really explained to us what we were doing. I mean, there was an effort to actually, you know, implement some sort of concussion protocol. But, you know, again, how possible is it to then, you know, kind of do a responsive test in the middle of a race? Because, you know, you jump back on your bike and oftentimes you're riding again before the team doctor is even there, or maybe it's a team, maybe it's not a doctor that you've, you know really well, or, you know, I don't want to say don't trust, but, you know, they're unfamiliar to you. But yeah, it's a really difficult kind of thing to like to quantify and, you know, figure out, like identifying the concussion. It's such a difficult thing in the sport of cycling to actually identify, because there's no timeouts, there's no, you know, locker room that you can be pulled aside. You know, essentially if you have to do a evaluation, then you're out of the race. So I have been, so I'm riding with specialized helmets now that have a program in them called ANGI, which is essentially is an impact detector. And at the moment, it's more of a kind of a safety feature. So if I were to crash and hit my head and there was a certain amount of force, you know, it would send a kind of an alarm to my phone or to my Wahoo head unit. And if I dismiss it within, you know, 10 seconds, you know, then it just kind of, it's dismissed. But if I don't, then my wife will be notified that I've had a crash and it'll send her my location. And that's, you know, phenomenal for people just out riding by themselves and, you know, recreational riders. But I've been speaking to them, is there a way to actually implement some sort of, you know, detection where, you know, if every rider in the race has this system in place, and if, you know, if there was a baseline, like, hey, if you receive this, if your helmet has this sort of impact, then you're just pulled from the race. Maybe the team director or the race director is notified and there's just no questions asked. But again, the difficulty in cycling is, you know, and with concussion is you could hit your head really hard and actually not have a concussion, you know, and they're so unique, you know, it's like every concussion and head injury is like a fingerprint. You know, someone might be unconscious for 5 minutes and not have any symptoms after. Someone might, you know, lightly tap their head on the pavement and have a concussion and symptoms that last for years.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where it comes back to the issue of kind of rotational forces. And that's to do with something I'm going to ask you in a minute about helmet testing standards. But as a good example, my most recent well, actually my last race and my most recent crash, it was a pretty big hit to my head. I remember, you know, I hit the floor with my head first, and I had this very, very clear thought as I kind of hit the floor and my head went smash. Well, that was a really hard hit to the head, so I'm not going to continue this race because I don't want to take the risk. But the thing is, actually, I amazingly didn't have concussion symptoms after that crash, and perhaps the kind of coherentness of my thoughts was a good indicator of the fact that I wasn't going to develop those concussion symptoms. But that is the problem. You know, I've had crashes where you think you're going to be fine, and then actually you've had really bad symptoms. And then this crash, I really smashed my head against the floor. But perhaps because it was a kind of a direct side impact and didn't have a rotational aspect, then I didn't have, that kind of rotational trauma to the brain, which is actually the biggest causer, one of the biggest causes of concussion. So, going back to helmet testing standards, I don't know how much you know about helmet testing standards, but basically the test is a vertical drop test, and it doesn't actually incorporate aspects of rotational forces. And I say the test, that doesn't really cover it, because there are multiple helmet standards. There isn't a single standard across the world. There's different standards that you can choose to comply to as a helmet manufacturer. But these rotational forces are the main drivers of concussion. Do you think there's more that can and should be done by helmet manufacturers to research and try to prevent rotational forces during crashes, seeing as they are some of the biggest problems?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the simple answer is yes, and it's constantly evolving. You know, helmets are continually improving and getting better. You know, now you see systems like MIPS, and you know, there are all sorts of additions to helmets that, you know, you look at, you know, even when I first started racing, helmets were pretty minimal. But, you know, there have been helmets. I mean, I recall, not to call out a brand, but there was a helmet that I used at Team Sky, a cask in early 2013 that was like Velcro, like the whole thing was Velcroed in, and it was incredibly dangerous. And I think it didn't approve or wasn't approved by the Australian helmet standards, but we were still able to race it in Australia just because, you know, we had brought the helmets from Europe. So there does need to be a more uniform kind of helmet, you know, kind of quality test. But, you know, another huge thing that I think when it comes to helmets is actually proper fit. You know, some people you do see, you know, maybe they have the helmet on and maybe it's a good helmet, but, you know, they have the straps are, you know, dangling, you know, 5 centimeters below their, you know, chin, and it's like, it's not tight in the back. And, you know, I've seen a lot of other pro riders kind of like reassemble their helmets, or like, you know, take stuff out. Like there was some riders that I've seen before, like take the MIPS system out of their helmet because they want it to be lighter or they want more airflow or something. I'm like, this is insane that you're disassembling a helmet for, it's like, you know, if you're going to do that, why would you even be wearing a helmet? Because this has been designed with all these different, you know, parts and pieces for a specific reason. And then riders, you know, ripping it out to make it as simple as possible. But it's
all about education, isn't it? Because that takes me back to that story that you told in the podcast about when you had this awful crash on your time trial bike when you weren't wearing a helmet, and then you raced the next day by actually cutting out some of the foam on the inside of your helmet so that you could fit your swollen head to the helmet. And so obviously, like, now knowing what you know and having had the experiences that you'd had, you'd never do that. I mean, you wouldn't race at all. But I think youth and inexperience and perhaps in education or lack of education are all contributing factors to kind of misuse of helmets.
Yeah, definitely. And again, it's such a challenging thing to kind of get around, because like I said, the athletes don't necessarily want to stop. You know, so one thing I've, and kind of this group that I'm working with to implement some sort of protocol has considered, is like, can we have contact of, you know, whether it's partners or parents of an athlete, because, you know, the athlete might not, especially in that moment, might not be thinking clearly, and they might have ulterior motives to get back and race, or, you know, it's an important race, so they want to be there. But if you just have a little bit of information and kind of knowledge of the long-term, you know, potential outcome of a crash, and then a subsequent crash, if you're jumped back on your bike and you're not fully there, you know, it can be extremely devastating. And, you know, there's been a few riders in the last years who have had a crash and, you know, pretty well documented concussion and returned to racing far too soon and very quickly had another crash. And you can't necessarily attribute that to a concussion, but you start to look at, you know, some of the statistics and like frequency of riders crashing, and you start to think like, huh, I wonder if, you know, maybe they do have an issue that's not been addressed and they're returning to race, you know, racing too soon. And by that, you know, potentially putting themselves at risk or, you know, crashing more frequently because, you know, they may have an issue that they don't even realize that, you know, you can have a concussion and your vision and eyes may be compromised.
Mm, yeah, and then that kind of altered sense of balance then puts you at much greater risk. Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's a real problem. And perhaps even, I mean, you were talking about how, you know, your injury meant that you were missing from the sport and then that put more pressure on your teammates. But perhaps it's even more of an issue in women's cycling where, you know, the salaries are much lower. There's much more pressure to perform and to kind of compete to get that spot because it's so ruthless because so many people want it. But I mean, of course, it's difficult across the board. But yeah, I don't know. It's really hard. My final question, which we kind of answered, but is there a way or how can we create a culture change that's athlete health orientated rather than finish the race and then see if you're okay? Because it is the biggest problem that the race is moving. And if you stop and if you try and have some sort of concussion protocol during the race, I mean, not only is it kind of pointless because the symptoms often don't come on till later, but you know, if you're going to have a concussion protocol test during a race, then you might as well just stop the race anyway, because the race is gone.
Yeah, no, I think there definitely needs to be a cultural change. So actually I've been contacted by a few specialists in the UK and Scotland about this, who work in rugby. And, you know, they'd kind of expressed how, you know, 10, 15 years ago in rugby, there was a very similar culture to concussion as there is in cycling now, where it's not really talked about. And I guess it's been more spoken about now in cycling. But, you know, they've had a very kind of drastic shift in their essentially awareness and kind of culture around concussion. And for the athletes to realize that, hey, like, this is a serious topic. You know, if you crash and, you know, there's this, I don't know what you'd call it, but there's this, you know, kind of romantic side of cycling where you see, you know, these legendary stages where someone crashes and breaks a collarbone. And, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, when I was growing up, Tyler Hamilton, like, you know, finishing the tour with a broken collarbone, thinking like, wow, that's incredible. Mm. Like that's
and
this.
And recently Lawson Craddock, you know, pushing his way through with a broken shoulder the whole time.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 And it's that culture that, you know, you have to be tough, which is, you know, so beautiful in cycling. The athletes, you know, you're so used to suffering on the bike that, you know, oftentimes a broken bone is going to hurt a lot more than a concussion in the moment. But I do think there has to be a, you know, awareness and just an understanding that, hey, these injuries can be a long-term, you know, problem in your life. And especially if there's, you know, multiple impacts and kind of repeated impacts, you know, bones heal and we can operate on bones fairly easily, but the brain is much more complex and takes a lot longer to heal and is much more fragile than a bone. So I think it really is going to come down to like a cultural shift in the sport and both teams and especially riders understanding that, hey, I hit my head. Maybe I don't even have a concussion, but I'm going to be cautious in this situation and be aware. And that the teams also support riders doing that, that the teams are like, hey, we respect that you've, you know, decided to stop the race because you hit your head. And now let's go through the proper, you know, protocols and channels to actually try and diagnose this and then figure out, are there any lingering symptoms?
Well, Lizzie, I've just in the corner of our Zoom screen, I've just seen a chink of blue sky. So we better wrap this up so you can get your last training ride in before your mammoth trek to Siena.
Yeah, I can see blue sky, but I can also see rain. So I'm not feeling too optimistic that I'm going to stay dry, but I'm going out anyway.
Well, good luck anyway, Lizzie. I'll speak to you next month when you will have how many race days in your legs by then?
One.
Really? Only the one?
Yeah, one. And, well, I guess the fact that you're here, Tom, we should have mentioned this at the top of the show, but the fact that you're here and not Richard means no baby yet.
Yeah, no baby this month, but the window of opportunity is now closing to do podcasts without there being a baby in the house. So, yeah, I think by the time we do this next one, I'll probably have a little girl, hopefully, if all goes well.
Wow, very exciting, Tom. You must keep us all updated.
I will. Thanks, Lizzie, and good luck. Drive safe and keep getting tested.
And best wishes for your baby delivery.
This episode of Service Course was produced by me. Our theme music is Beyond the Black Veil by the brilliant Moscow Youth Cult. Do go and check them out. And the rest of the tracks in the show come via Epidemic Sound. For details of the individual tracks, then please check the show notes. Thanks again.